Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Best estimates are that hundreds of homes and structures have been destroyed by fires in this first series of wildfires raging in states from California to New Jersey and down to the Florida Panhandle. Those are the human homes. But what about the animal homes? Any idea how many burrows, nests, dens, and homes of the wild creatures have been consumed? We're heading to the Okefenokee Swamps to take a look when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. The 2007 fire season is heating up, and it's already dominating the news. With global warming likely moving the earth into a drier, hotter trend, the wildfires are quicker to ignite and spread with the storm-driven winds into some very frightening and dangerous situations for thousands of our friends in California, Minnesota, Canada, and a new human-caused fire now rages in New Jersey. Hundreds of buildings and homes have already been lost, and the economic and community costs are staggering. But there are more to these fires than that. As most are burning in swamps, forests, mountains, and even islands, the world of nature is as well being hit, and hit hard. In Florida, the smoke has been so intense from the current fires that have moved into northern Florida from the weeks-old blaze in the Okefenokee swamps that birds are literally dropping from the sky. Stories of bear cubs stranded in trees are appearing, and there is a much deeper story, and that's where we go, following a brief look at today's nature news. So now, the news. A big area of snow in the Antarctic melted in 2005 due to an unusually warm week in summer. Scientists believe this melt could have accelerated the underground melting, but cannot know as it would have occurred in areas that cannot be measured at this time. Although Antarctica has not been as affected as the Arctic by climate change, this event indicates unusual warming trends can have long-term impacts on the overall stability of ice sheets generally around the world. The ongoing drought in Australia could create a much worse water shortage than had been predicted. Australians have been told to brace for some of the most restrictive water use regulations on record. Many in Australia are already under tight restrictions which ban washing cars and outlaw the use of sprinklers in gardens. As well, some plans are being made to relocate farms to more northern areas of the Australian continent. Recent predictions indicate that the water levels in the nation's rivers could be fully 40% less than thought. Prime Minister John Howard has urged Australians to pray for rain. Dry conditions in Asia are kicking up a lot of dust, which is heading into the atmosphere and could impact climate in the U.S. Following a recent series of Pacific flights and especially equipped aircraft, scientists observed that dust clouds easily and regularly cross the Great Ocean, but before doing so, pick up unusually high levels of carbon particulates that can darken the skies and could absorb more heat than regular clouds. The long-term effects of the dust clouds are being determined. India is being urged to reject the campaign by the Chinese to lift bans on the trading of tiger parts. China will be appealing for removal of the ban during the next meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species in The Hague in June. China contends that although its tiger population is down to about 30 animals, they have over 5,000 in captive breeding farms, which they use to supply the demands for tiger parts in the world's markets. Conservationists contend that although this may seem a reasonable proposal on one hand, it nevertheless will encourage the illegal poaching and killing of wild tigers by illegal brokers and would in fact lead to hurting the existing wild tiger populations worldwide. Japan is busy spreading foreign aid money to buy votes of client countries that will be voting on the whaling ban. Last year, Japan managed to get the International Whaling Commission to agree to a rather toothless declaration that the ban was unnecessary. Campaigners say Japan has been doling out aid to non-whaling countries such as in Africa, while asking that they join the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, to sway the vote in favor of the pro-whaling proposals. Scientists report that, like humans, birds too have been hard hit by the West Nile virus. The virus, which has been responsible for over 12,000 cases of West Nile virus in humans, with 960 deaths since appearing in 1999, appears to as well affect birds, commonly associated with human populations, including crows, robins, chickadees, and eastern bluebirds. Crow populations have declined by 45% since 1999, and scientists attribute the cause to West Nile virus. Some scientists see a future in which many of these backyard species of birds will be essentially gone from neighborhoods. Generally, the appearance of West Nile virus results in a concurrent and equivalent disappearance of many bird species. And finally, 230 scientists signed a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service offering their opposition to plans by Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho to remove the endangered status of wolves in those states. Scientists claim that the proposals to delist the wolves were not based on real science. Currently, about 1,300 wolves exist in the three-state area. The Fish and Wildlife Service contends that that is more than enough wolves to merit the removal of protections as an endangered species. The delisting proposal could be completed by early next year, but legal challenges may keep the current status in place for some time. And that's the news. I don't like to be an alarmist, but I have to believe this could be a record-setting year of fires across America. With the effects of a long-standing drought adding to the dangers, as well as more intense storms with lightning that have been appearing with such extreme impact in recent weeks, we all need to be aware of our surroundings these days. We start out with a couple of quick updates from two of the current fire sites. First, a quick update from northern Minnesota. There's a serious forest fire that's happening up in Minnesota as well right now and isn't getting the same press that others are, possibly because it isn't threatening, or some people would say it isn't threatening as many homes, but in reality there's been many homes and other structures lost there. To get an update on what's happening in Minnesota, we're talking with Jeff Edmonds, who's the fire information officer with the incident management team. Jeff, tell us what's going on up in northern Minnesota.
Well, we have a fire here that's almost 76,000 acres. Started in Minnesota and burned into Canada in a major run a few days ago last Thursday, and then burned back into Minnesota from Canada. So it's been an international incident here. We've had a couple hundred structures threatened and lost a total of 133 on both sides as of last report. Some of those are residences, some are storage buildings and sheds. It's been a major fire, and a good portion of it is in the Boundary Waters Wilderness in northern Minnesota.
I'm just curious if you have any information on what's happening to wildlife that are impacted by these fires as they approach. What's the story on how they handle this?
Well, wildlife seems to adapt. This area, historically, is a fire-prone area. There's records of, fires as far back as they can reach with the tree rings, over the last several hundred years, and wildfire occurs here, and it has for a long time, and the wildlife has adapted to that. I'm not a wildlife biologist. I'm not real sure how they survived that, but we haven't found that. I've heard dead animals out on the fire. I've seen a few photos posted online of, like a fox curled up on a burned out area, but the fox appears to be just fine. It's just all just huddled up on a rock like they tend to do, and so things manage to survive.
It's fascinating. What's the prognosis on the future of this fire?
It's looking really good. We've had about 3 days of fairly calm weather, higher humidity, a little bit of drizzle, not enough to put a fire out, but enough to slow down the activity and allow firefighters to get in close. And so they're building line as fast as they can. And we've lifted some evacuations just in the last couple of days. The sheriff has done that, and people are pretty happy about being able to go back to their homes, even though some of them don't have homes to go back to.
Right. Jeff Edmonds, Fire Information Officer with the Incident Management Team up in Minnesota. I want to wish you guys all good luck and be safe up there, and hope you get this under control.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Bye. The Catalina Island Fire appears to have burned itself out. A new fire in New Jersey is so new, we are still waiting for reports to be filed. Florida is now the current hotspot, and we now go there for this update. Now joining us from Florida is Rhonda Sutphin, who is with the Florida Division of Forestry, who is here to give us a sense of what's happening with the forest fires in Florida right now. Rhonda?
Yeah, we have several large fires burning across the state of Florida. As of today, we have 203 active wildfires that are burning 176,811 acres. And the fire we have the most concern about is the one on the Baker-Columbia County line, which is up in the Florida-Georgia state line. And that fire is now approximately 119,000 acres. So far, they've been able to contain about 50% of that fire, and the fire is still within its lines. And hopefully, the weather will be favorable again today for operations on that one. But we're worried about the weather as it comes in this weekend. The low relative humidity and high wind, the drier air that'll come in after the front may make that fire flare up.
Are there storms associated with that? Because that increases the chances of lightning as well?
Yes, there's a front that's supposed to move across the state starting today through the weekend, and there will be scattered showers, but unfortunately with that, you also get a lot of lightning.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you finding with the winds then that it takes the embers and has a capacity to really spread this beyond those your boundaries?
Yes, because when we have low relative humidity and higher winds, the fire can, what we call, cause spot fires anywhere from a quarter of a mile to a mile away. So if they jump over our containment lines, they start new fires elsewhere, and if we can't get to those quickly to get those suppressed, then you have another new fire.
Some people are talking about the smoke and its effect on pets and as well birds, just native birds.
It, the smoke can be a problem with these large fires because there's nowhere for it to go. So we're just asking people, if they have pets, if they can bring them indoors, try to limit people exposure and pets exposure to the smoke, which will help out a lot. And, as far as wildlife and birds, they get a little disoriented with the smoke, and there's unfortunately nothing we can do about that.
Well, Rhonda Sutphin with the Florida Division of Forestries, good luck. We'll keep posted.
All right. Thank you.
The Florida fire is the direct result of fires that have been burning in Georgia for the last 2 weeks. Our report continues as we head on up to the Okefenokee Swamps. Joining us now from the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge is Ranger Sally Gentry. Sally, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I have to say the Okefenokee Swamp is one of the best-named national wildlife refuges in the world. I think everybody just loves the name of that.
Do you know what Okefenokee means?
No, let's start with that one then.
Okay, it's called Land of the Trembling Earth, and it actually presents the first problem that our fire crews are having in fighting this fire down here.
Why the Land of the Trembling Earth?
Well, the Okefenokee Swamp has a lot of peat as part of the bottom of this swamp, and it builds up in several feet thick in places, and so it's virtually impossible to get heavy equipment out through that swamp to fight these fires. If you were to drive them out through there, you would pretty much sink. So Land of the Trembling Earth, it's very hard to fight fires in there, as well as it being a large wilderness area, so there are no roads that go through the Okefenokee Swamp itself.
Right, which of course is what it's all about, really, is to protect these wilderness areas. It's about over 400,000 square acres and over 300,000 designated wilderness, I think. Is that about right?
It's 402,000 acres approximately, and of that, 353,000 acres are National Wilderness Area.
For those of us who haven't had a chance to visit the Okefenokee Swamp, and I'm going to have to get down there one of these days soon because I need to experience that more. You've been a ranger there. Give us a sense of what people see when they come there. What are the habitats like? What are the dominant features?
Well, the habitats are actually vary in different places of the swamp. You have something that the forested cypress wetlands, which predominate the northwest side of the swamp, and that's what most people have in mind when they think of the Okefenokee Swamp. We have these large cypress trees and the waterways that kind of wind away around the base of the trees. And then in other areas, say the northern end of the swamp, you have a lot of scrub shrub habitat, which is very thick, dense, various shrubs that grow very thickly. And then in other areas, you have open, wet, shallow prairies where you'll find a lot of your wading birds. There's also lakes that dot the Okefenokee Swamp, as well as some waterways, including the Suwannee Canal, which was a man-made feature that was put through in the 1890s in an attempt to drain the swamp.
The cypress forest, I guess, how do you refer to that, by the way? How would you refer to the cypress area?
Well, we do call it a cypress forest because that is the predominant tree.
Uh-huh.
And probably the last habitat area in the Okefenokee Swamp is the forested uplands, so the sandy upland area. So there are islands within the swamp itself, even in the boggy areas, and there are upland pine sand communities around the edges of the Okefenokee Swamp where you have different sorts of vegetation that grow there as well.
Therefore, you have a terrific diversity of wildlife, and that's what I'm going to be focusing on in our discussion here. I am curious what is happening in these devastating fires. The Okefenokee Swamp has really been hit, and I think a lot of people are concerned about how in the world do wildlife native to the swamps there into your National Wildlife Refuge, how do they actually deal with this? What's happening?
Well, it depends on the wildlife you're talking about. Most of the wildlife that inhabits the Okefenokee Swamp are adapted to that ecosystem because the swamp itself is a fire-dependent ecosystem. Without fire to rejuvenate the swamp, it would basically become just a peat-filled bog. So most of the animals that survive in the Okefenokee Swamp for generations have adapted to it, and so they have ways that they can handle that situation when it happens.
Let's first of all start with the bird life. What are you observing in terms of how they've been able to react to the oncoming fires?
Well, the birds are really fortunate because they're actually able to fly away and then return to an area. And so fire within the swamp is actually good for some of our birds like the Florida sandhill cranes and the red-cockaded woodpeckers that live there. And it's good in a way. Florida sandhill cranes, for instance, what that will do is open up those prairies, keep them from becoming filled with the shrubs that would take over. So that provides them more foraging habitat. And for the red-cockaded woodpeckers, the trees that they require to thrive are longleaf pine trees, and they live in these upland pine communities. Without fire to come through, then a lot of your other vegetation would start growing up. Some of your less fire-dependent trees would come up, and they would start crowding out the longleaf pines. And so to have regular fires and what we call prescribed fires that we actually go out and do keeps that vegetation down and keeps that habitat that the red-cockaded woodpeckers need. And red-cockaded woodpeckers are an endangered species, one of the main species that we manage for at the Okefenokee Swamp.
How is this fire coming in terms of the nesting season? Because, of course, that they could lose a considerable portion of this year's young if it comes at the wrong time. Where are you in that process?
Well, I did speak to our biologist last week about that. At that point, they had started building nests, and they had not documented any eggs or young yet at this time. So that's a good thing. So as the fire is coming through the swamp, the woodpeckers would leave, and they would return to that area and continue nesting. Most likely is
probably
what would happen.
For example, bird nests are blown out of trees all the time. They have to restart, so that's not an uncommon thing.
Well, and the woodpeckers, of course, are nesting internally in cavities.
Well, that's true.
So they're more protected, and the longleaf pine trees that they nest in are already fire-resistant species of tree. So the fire can come through there, and those trees will still remain, and most will be okay. In fact, we do prescribe burning just for that, you know, to keep out the other shrubs and stuff, because without doing that, then you get all this fuel buildup around the bottom of the longleaf pines. Then when you have a wildfire that comes through, the fire has a lot of what we call fuel to burn, and it, if it burns up in the tops of those trees, then it will kill those trees, so we want to keep that from happening. So we come in and we do prescribe burning on a regular cycle to keep all that undergrowth down. So when the fire does come through there, which it will, it's a natural part of that ecosystem, then it's not a devastating big fire that tops out the crowns of those trees. It will come through, burn what undergrowth is there, and keep going, and the trees will remain alive.
Maybe we should give a little history on this particular event in terms of how long it was in the swamp, and if it still is, and it's how the status of its containment, and also the nature of the fire. Was it a slow burn, which can be very difficult, or did it kind of breeze through, or what's going on?
Well, we actually have a couple of different fires burning in the swamp right now. We have one at the north end of the swamp, which started out, I believe the date was April the 16th, and it moved into the swamp on April the 22nd into the National Wildlife Refuge. And that one's sort of been creeping down through the refuge, various rates depending on the day and the wind and the fuels that it encountered. We have a second fire, and, well, the big turnaround at this point has burned about 130,000 acres. About 84,000 of that is what we call the big turnaround portion of the fire, which is a lot of that on the refuge. And then the other portion was the 46,000 acres on the Sweat Farm fire.
Well, those are big fires. That's a lot of landmass.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And we have a second fire that started last Saturday night, which was May the 5th, I believe. There was a thunderstorm that came through the area. We had over 1,000 lightning strikes that night. And out of that, there were some fires that sprang up. There was one that started out on Floyd's Island Prairie around the central area of the swamp. And then we had one that started on Bugaboo Island, which is also an active nesting colony of red cockaded woodpeckers in the middle of the swamp, in the middle of the wilderness area. And that fire on Sunday was about 300 acres. And on Monday, it ran about 9 miles south. So it covered a lot of ground in one day.
So,
and now that fire, the Bugaboo Scrub Fire, mm-hmm. has grown to a total of 242,000 acres.
Right.
And 139,000 of that is just in the South Georgia part alone. And it's spilled over down into northern Florida as well.
Right. That's an ongoing event right now. In terms of the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, how much of the refuge actually has been burned?
I don't have a number for that. I mean, I can look at a map and say, well, it looks like...
No, just estimate,
well,
you know.
Let me think. Mm-hmm. Okay, if we've got... The Okefenokee Swamp is 402,000 acres, and the turnaround is 84, and the Georgia portion is 139. So that's over 200,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
So... Roughly half,
yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, as well, the mammal species. What would you say are some of your top five or so mammal species that you'd find in the refuge?
Well, probably our largest mammal would be the black bears. And that would be a species that would probably have some problems with this fire because they're not able to run as fast as a deer could run. They might have more trouble getting out. And there was a study recently conducted in the Okefenokee Swamp ecosystem, and they found that there were a population of about 800 black bears. But they ranged through what we call a greenway, which is basically the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, and then south through Pinhut Swamp, and then into northern Florida in the Osceola National Forest. So that population of black bears normally inhabits that range.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this fire has... raced through the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, has moved south into Pinhook Swamp and through Pinhook Swamp and is now in Osceola National Forest. So it's basically covering a lot of the same habitat that those black bears inhabit. That could be some concern.
Yeah, they have limited resources in terms of running. There was a story that just came out about a mother bear that was found at the base of a tree with a cub about 60 feet up. And she was somehow protecting that tree or couldn't get up herself, but they darted both of them and were able to rescue them. So this is the type of thing that can begin to happen. I'm sure you'll be hearing some stories. But how about the things like raccoons and other smaller mammal species? Because, again, they can't run as fast. What is your sense on how they're handling and responding to this fire?
There are going to be some species that are going to be negatively impacted. There are going to be some, like rabbits. They have their burrows in the ground, so hopefully they'll be able to find somewhere to run to and hide until the fire blows over. Same with raccoons. They often nest in holes in trees, stumps of trees in the root base and different places like that. Hopefully they were able to find somewhere like that to hide. And often, even if the fire's coming through, because this is, you know, a bog wetland down here, hopefully they're able to, you know, find a wet area to even just get across and wait until that fire comes through and kind of wind their way on back around. But we really don't have any way of knowing at this point.
Yeah, we'll have to check back with you and find out how this manifests. I've been around fires in wildlife areas, and the animals take to the water. Deer, you'll find deer just standing, you know, in the water,
mm-hmm.
With fires burning all around. So they do have this innate knowledge about what to do.
Mm-hmm.
One of the complicating aspects of this particular fire is the fact that it's been so very dry that actually the water resources are somewhat limited.
Well, you are right about that. We are experiencing a drought here in the Okefenokee Swamp, which is certainly a complicated matter. We were already seeing concentrations of alligators where you normally wouldn't see that many alligators in one area. Spring is mating season for the alligators, and normally they become more territorial during that time. And so you're seeing, you know, a drought. So you've got a concentration of alligators at a time when they become more territorial and aggressive toward each other. Their food supply is dwindling because their food is the fish and the snakes and turtles and frogs and whatnot that you would find in that environment, the same as the alligator inhabits. Well, you know, it's affecting the fish as well as it's affecting the alligator. So as their food supplies dwindle, they will turn cannibalistic and turn on each other. And we did have an incident of that happen a couple of weeks ago before the fire started. We had a report of someone seeing that happen. So, and that's, you know, not unusual, too, just naturally for that to happen if you have a big alligator that might prey on a smaller alligator. But it is a sign of, you know, some stress and in the environment. And so you've already got a low water level down here, and then you have this big fire come through where you have less wet areas for animals to go for protection. So that is a factor that plays into it.
In terms of the open water, how deep typically in a normal season would the waters be? And obviously if they can get into those waters, they're protected.
Well, it really does vary, because when I mentioned earlier that open, wet, shallow prairies, by shallow I mean inches.
Right.
So you have prairies out there where your wading birds normally are feeding at, and, you know, those prairies are drying up, you know, have dried up, are drying up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are canals or channels out there where alligators would normally be. At the deepest, most places in the swamp, you know, maybe 10, 12, 14 feet deep.
Right.
You know, maybe a little bit deeper. So we're just seeing, you know, significant drying of a lot of those areas.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. And you make the point that this is a natural occurrence. This certainly is not the first time that the swamps have been burned. They've been burning for thousands and thousands of years. So the animals that you find there are pretty well adapted, and they may get a hit. There's definitely going to be a hit.
Well, you're right about that. And it is a cycle, and the swamp does need it for rejuvenation. Like I said earlier, that it would basically just turn into, you know, a scrub shrub boggy area if it didn't burn out. And, you know, historically you have these big fires, and this is what we're seeing, is basically a part of that natural cycle, because the last really big fire like this that the swamp had was back in 1954 or 55, and the same conditions existed then. You know, you have a drought period where a lot of that peat dries out, and then you'll have a wildfire come through, and it will burn down into that peat, burn that peat out, open those lakes up, you know, and it's part of that cycle. And so we are at about that 50-year period, and we are in that drought period. So all the things were sort of in line for something like this on a natural level to occur. You know, that doesn't mean it's not devastating at the time that it happens. And certainly we want to work to protect any interest around the swamp, and homes and lives are our priority.
I think the bottom line is the fact that, yes, there's going to be animals that are going to go down in this process, but it is a natural process. It's happened many times before, and I would guess that if we talk 5 years from now, you'll have a whole different story. So as you look out into the future, how is this going to affect your role at the wildlife refuge?
Well, it's something that we already do, is try to explain to people the role of fire in this ecosystem. It also serves to highlight why we do prescribed burning, that's usually a good thing, because it burns out those fuels that would accumulate and just add to that fire when something like this does happen. So, you know, prescribed burning is a good thing, something that you can control, and you do it in a very methodical, scientific way. So we're prepared for when something like this comes, or as prepared as you can be.
Well, I think it's interesting. It's almost as if there's really been kind of a change, that people who are involved in refuge management and wildlife management, obviously these are tragedies in many different ways, and there's certainly issues that, in terms of protecting property and your facilities, et cetera. But in reality, I would guess that you sort of look at this as, this is part of nature expressing itself.
Well, a long time ago, they used to try to put out those fires at the Okefenokee Swamp. You know, they would send in into the swamp itself, you know, try every resource that they had, you know, flying through the swamp, and it just doesn't work. I mean, experience has just shown, you know, the cost is just prohibitive, just incredible. And it's logistically impossible to get the equipment and the firefighters out there in that swamp to fight it. So what we do as an agency is we maintain a perimeter boundary around it, a fire line, if you will. And we keep that. We work with local landowners, local agencies like Georgia Forestry Commission, and we all work together. In fact, there's a partnership called the Greater Okefenokee Association of Landowners, and they meet regularly and discuss, and they work together when they have fires, no matter, you know, well, whoever's land it's on, they work together. They have a plan of action when something like this happens. And so now we have these big fires, and there's a plan in place, and everybody's working together cooperatively very well in handling this.
Wildlife refuges are precisely that, wildlife refuges, but they also, let me rephrase that, wildlife refuges, but they also offer recreational activities. I think at this point the swamp is closed to the public, but once it reopens, tell us what people will be experiencing when they come there and what sort of recreational resources they can expect.
When they come to the Okefenokee Swamp after these fires go through, it's going to look different. People may remember back when Yellowstone burned. And there was a backlash about letting it burn. They wanted it put out because it looked bad and whatever. And the same thing's going to happen here. It's, you know, people don't want to come to the swamp and see burnt areas. But that's going to be part of what it is. But the swamp is going to rejuvenate itself very quickly. I mean, it's going to green back up very quickly. The birds are going to come back. The wildlife's going to come out. And, you know, life is going to resume as normal for the wildlife and the refuge and the swamp out there.
And that's the exciting news in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, oftentimes the restorative feature that adds more diversity and increases the amount of life and time.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
That's right.
We've been talking with Ranger Sally Gentry with the Okefenokee Swamp National Wildlife Refuge in Georgia that's been going through the fires. If people want to find out more about the resource, where should they go?
Well, we do have a website, and it's called www.fws, which is short for Fish and Wildlife Service, .gov/Okefenokee.
You better spell that.
Okefenokee.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck in the weeks ahead here, and maybe we'll have a chat again to see how things are recovering.
Thank you, Sydney.
Keep your eyes open, and be particularly careful to avoid doing anything that could set our world on fire. Things are heating up in more ways than one, and we must make special efforts to do the right things. So be careful until next week, when we meet again on Thursday or any time on the archives, when the weekly Earth Summit reconvenes. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. See you next week, when your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.